the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true. I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. The first voice you heard was that of Syreeta singing Sunny with Ella Fitzgerald's favorite jazz pianist, Joe Pass, with whom she did a couple of best-selling albums. And, of course, you recognize the next voice, probably the greatest pop singer of the century, Francis Sinatra, when he introduced me the night he took over the Tonight Show from Johnny Carson and asked me to be on the show. This is John Barber. It's 8 o'clock here in Las Vegas, and it on the 17th of August, and this is like the 35th day of over 105 degree heat. I must tell you, hell is cooler. And if you saw the debates a little over a week ago, you know Shakespeare was absolutely right when he said, "Hell is empty. All the devils are up here." Anyway, I want to welcome you to this very, very special hour tonight, something that we have never done, and I'm so delighted to be doing it because I wouldn't be doing it for anyone else. This hour is sort of a tip of the hat to my very favorite people, comedians, and to one in particular. I love them all, the jerks and the giants, and some of them were both, especially Johnny Carson. But having been one myself, not a jerk or a giant, but a comic for many years, I loved them all because I knew and know how tough and lonely it is out there. There is no profession braver. A soldier, even in Iraq, has a rifle in his hand and an army equally armed. He's not alone. A singer has his guitar or piano or orchestra behind him, probably doing a song written by somebody else. He's not alone, but a comic is. He is at war with himself and the audience, badly outnumbered, unlike any other profession. Not only sometimes is his body at risk, but so is his very soul. It is so dangerously lonely. If he does not get laughs, he just doesn't die. He bombs, and if he gets those laughs, he kills. I remember them all from their beginnings, and even some of their lines. When I was a 10-year-old kid in Toronto in the 40s, listening to Bob broadcasting from Fort Ord Hope, I recall the very first joke NBC censored him for. Did you hear about the 12-year-old girl who accidentally swallowed a safety pin? She didn't feel the prick till she was 16. Jack Parr, the Tonight Show's very best host, appropriately saying during an election cycle, "I don't vote, it just encourages them." Jackie Mason in his very first appearance in the Steve Allen Show in the 50s saying, "I'm so insecure, when I go to a football game and they huddle, I think they're talking about me." And Mort Saul, when Russia launched Sputnik, saying, "It just proves the Russians' German scientists are better than our German scientists." I also remember the brilliant cutting-edge routines of Lenny Bruce, Bill Hicks, and later George Carlin, and the inventive, stomach-hurting ad-lib hilarity of Jonathan Winters. But one routine by a young, unknown comic I'd accidentally seen in the coffee house in L.A., years ago when I was a critic at NBC, never left me. It was a routine about the English language and how difficult and nonsensical it is to me. America's wisest, funniest, wittiest comic in print is Mark Twain. His Noah's Ark puts Bill Cosby's routine to shame, as does Bill Cosby's behavior. This young man's routine on the language was the equal to anything Mark Twain ever wrote. It evidenced an intelligence that, frankly, I have never seen since. There is nothing more satisfying than an audience, for an audience like me, to laugh and to learn. When I left Real People, one of the first things I did was go to Showtime to do an hour special called John Barber's World. I went there because I wanted to do with reality on Showtime what this young man was now doing hilariously and imaginatively with comedy, props, and watermelons. My reality was no match for his comedy, and neither was anybody else's comedy. His much-watched specials on Showtime absolutely laid the groundwork for every other comic's cable special ever since, but none, including the spontaneous genius of Robin Williams, ever matched the sheer joy and pleasure and popularity of my guest. That is why tonight's show is a special, because there is nobody as special as Gallagher. Gallagher, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for being here.
What a wonderful introduction. I hope I live up to it.
Well, listen, if you were writing it, you would far surpass it. Now, look, you are one of these rare famous performers who gets to be known by just one name, Elvis, Cher, and Gallagher. Okay, you were born Leo Anthony Gallagher Jr. Do your friends or family call you Leo Anthony Tony Jr. or Gallagher?
Well, since I'm a junior, I couldn't be called Leo because that was my dad's name. So my father gave me a nickname, which is no longer PC appropriate.
Listen, this is internet radio. If you want to say your name, you can say your name. Do your friends or family still call you by that nickname?
Yes.
Okay, what is it?
I'm not going to tell you, because when I go to the stage, they'll all yell it out as I'm going to the stage.
That's
you
true.
See, my show starts in the lobby. At 7 o'clock when they come into the theater, I'm right there with them. I appreciate my audience and my fans, and I want to talk to them. I'm not going to sit in the dressing room and wonder what they're like. I go out there and I meet them, and I touch them, and I hear their vocabulary, and I see how they dress, and I discover whether they've come as a family or as a group from work, and I do my audience research at that time. So then I walk from the lobby to the stage. I don't come out from the wings. So as I'm walking, they can say things to me, and then I crawl up onto the stage from the audience. And so that's why I know. A lot of them know my nickname, and they yell it out anyway. I just don't want to give them any more.
Okay. Then how would you like me to address you, as Leo or as Gallagher?
Gallagher. You can call me Mr. G. Pick up other names.
And I must tell you, I am really delighted that this is not a television show, because you have a mind that paints unbelievably intelligent, brilliant, funny pictures. And I have this list in front of me, this bucket list, that proves that not only was your mind great then, but it has expanded like the universe since then. But we won't get to the bucket list just yet, Mr. G, because bucket lists come at the end of life, and they will come toward the end of this show. I would like to get back to a little bit about your roots. You mentioned your father. Do you have siblings? Are you married now? Do you have children? And how did you get from where you were born to Florida? And when you went to Florida, what did you major in, and what did you want to do?
But if you're going to talk about roots for a guy named Gallagher, it has to start in Ireland, in Donegal, Gallagher is the 14th most common name in Ireland and the most popular name in Donegal. That's where my tribe is from, and we're mercenaries. We'll kill people for you, and we have no skills, artistic or any otherwise. So my hammer is more or less similar to the weapons that my ancestors had. And there was only three men between me and Donegal. There's Patrick, who came over around the turn of the century, and he met a woman named Kennedy and had Francis. And Francis Gallagher met my grandmother from Croatia. Her name was Jadrik, and he taught her to smoke cigarettes and rub rose petals on her cheeks, and they were an Adagio dancing team. So it was show business from the beginning in the Pittsburgh area, because I look at the phone books. Remember phone books way back? Well, I could find out from phone books as I traveled around the United States where all the Gallaghers are, and they're all in Pittsburgh. I think they came over to work in the coal mine.
Okay.
But anyway, when I meet someone named Gallagher, I say, do you have relatives in Pittsburgh? And of course they all do. And so after Francis had my father, Leo Sr., then there's me. So there's only three men, my father and Francis and Patrick, between me and my roots in Ireland. I'm thinking of going back to Ireland. I want them to welcome back this place. You know, it's wonderful if you're from the place you live and you've always lived there. But, you know, I don't have that. I'm displaced. I'm transplanted here in the United States. And you talk about loneliness. Sometimes I miss being part of a tribe.
Well,
and
you know,
so I'm looking forward to that.
In 1966, when I was first starting as a comic, and my best friend and mentor was Red Fox, whom I put on a variety show. I was the first one in America to put Red on a variety show, and I had created this concept for an album at the height of the civil rights movement, and it was called It's Tough to Be White, and he got Dick Gregory, and my wife got Dick Gregory also to do the liner notes for the album. But if I were to do an album today, I would say It's Tough to Be Bright, and you are certainly one of the brightest people around. Okay, now you go to Florida. This is long before you pick up your sledgehammer.
Well, the reason we went to Florida was because I got asthma and I couldn't breathe. And my father had always wanted to go to Florida. And so this was a good reason. So he was only 27 at the time, and I was 7 or 8. And we loaded 4 kids and a Great Dane in a Mercury wagon. And we headed down to Tampa, Florida, because it was a working man's town. And my dad didn't have a high school education. And so he wanted a place where he could find a job. And we ended up in Tampa, Florida.
In Florida, in Tampa. What did you major in school? I think you had a minor in English, as my son did. But what was your major?
Staying out of the draft. Even though I was a mercenary, I knew I wouldn't be a good soldier. I would have just shot them all. They all looked the same. I couldn't tell what was a friend or not. And I told them that. I went down to the draft board, and I met the woman who was sending me letters all the time. I just couldn't wait for things to show up in the mailbox. And I said, you shouldn't try to draft me. I'm not the kind of a person to be there. And she agreed. And she told me what I could do to stay out of the draft, and one of the things was to put braces on my teeth if you were undergoing some kind of a medical treatment. But then I was lucky enough to be arrested for marijuana in around 1962, I think. It's all in my police record, and that kept me out for years. It was a wonderful thing. Saved my life, I'm sure.
Okay. You minored in English. So
well, here's what I would do. If you change your major, they would reclassify your 2S. And so I changed my major all the time. Plus, what I was interested in, girls aren't interested in. But I was interested in girls. And so I noticed there were no girls in the physics department and engineering. So I would take school teaching courses over in the teaching building and meet all the girls. And so I didn't care much about my major. I really got a renaissance education by being in all the different buildings at the University of South Florida. Now, this university was didn't have a football team. It was supposed to be for evening students, adults. And
right.
So their motto was accent on learning. Now that they have a football team, they've had to take that down. I think the accent is on beer.
Okay, it seems so far your life is something that you don't want to do. You don't want to be in engineering. You don't want to be in the Army. Did you have any idea? You obviously knew you were funny and very witty.
Oh, I like chemistry. I took all chemistry courses. I love mathematics and chemistry. And so I just, as a night student, you didn't have to have a guy that told you you had to take English and all those other boring general studies. And so I got a job right away with Kaiser Aluminum as a chemist. And when
You're
everyone
kidding.
Else was waiting on tables, I had a really good job. I had a whole nitric acid plant before I could even drink beer. I could. I had a very explosive plant. There was a lot of gases at high pressure and
is
ammonia.
Is it still there?
It is. It's near 301. It was purchased by Kaiser Aluminum. And I was their youngest chief chemist they ever had. But when I got arrested for drugs, they came into my lab and thinking I was going to make LSD there or something. And they fired me a little bit after that. And I had an adventure with life. I didn't really want to do anything in particular. I wanted to sample all the different ways of living in America. And I wrote a book and printed it on newsprint and put it in the back of my car and sold
them at
rock concerts.
What was the book called?
It was called The Mailman Cometh, and it was about sex, of course, in the 60s. And I would sell it for whatever they would give me. I would sit down with kids at a car race or a rock concert, and I'd say, you want to buy a book? And they'd say, what's it about? And I'd say, sex. And I'd say, you want to hear some of it? And then I'd read the first paragraph. And then they'd give me a quarter or 15 cents. I had a suitcase full of change.
I would have loved to have seen you take that book, The Postman Always Rings Twice, and rewrite it as
well,
The Postman Always Comes Twice.
I got it from that title, but I called it The Mailman Cometh. But it was allegorical back in the 60s.
Okay.
A lot of things were happening. I'm not quite as old as you, but I remember when television was invented.
Oh gosh. No, I think
I remember some of the first. I think I got on TV so my father would talk to me, because he would just watch TV all the time. So I thought, if I get on TV, he'll have to see me.
Well, okay, I want to get to that relationship in a minute, but you went from Florida to California, to Los Angeles, and I believe I saw you in the Ice House. What prompted you to do your first stand-up, and were you in any way fearful of doing it?
No. I my father owned a skating rink, and so I roller skated from the time I was 16 until I was about 20. And I was a champion in dance and figure skating and freestyle jumps and spins. And the amount of time and preparation that it takes to get yourself ready for a competition is so much more than these comedians put into their act, that once I started comedy, I blew them away, because I was ready to work on a routine and present it. And if you don't have wheels on your feet, there's no problem.
Well,
you know, it was very easy to walk out on a stage and just stand there and talk. That's
was
so easy
your,
compared
was your
to
first
roller skating.
Routine, that routine I saw about the English language, I believe I remember one of the lines. Tell me if I am wrong. Why is it that we park in a driveway and drive in a parkway? And then you went through the thing with the O-U-G-H. I must tell you, Mr. G, it was beyond brilliant. It was absolutely staggering. Was that your first routine?
No. When I got done with selling my book out of my car. My car broke down. And I was laying on the floor of a friend's apartment watching TV, a Vegematic commercial, and I said to myself, why don't they just smash it with a hammer? You don't need to julienne the carrots if you're going to chew them. And so I wrote then the Sledge-O-Matic routine, and I sent it to George Carlin and Albert Brooks.
Wow. And was there a response from them? You wrote it for them?
Only George wrote me back. George says he writes all his own material. Thank you very much. And I want to thank George and his spirit right now because I must have earned $40 or $50 million with that routine, and he gave it back to me.
Yes. Now, but at the time, you were not doing...
I didn't even want to be a comedian. I wanted to be a writer. And so I would have been just as happy to be George Carlin's writer. And so that's all I wanted to do. So what I did was I got a job in a restaurant. Even though I had been a chief chemist, I needed to fix my car. And everybody at the restaurant said, you're funny. You ought to be a comedian. And I thought, well, I've got that routine. So I called an agent in the Yellow Pages, and he was the agent for Jim Stafford. And so I met Jim Stafford. That's correct. And so I watched Jim's act, and for some reason I felt like I could help him. And so I approached him and I said, I think I can write jokes for you. And so we started writing funny songs. We had the first song about homosexuals that was ever on the radio, My Girl Bill, and the first song about marijuana, Wildwood Weed. And then when he got the routine, got the song Spiders and Snakes, his career took off. And I thought, well, I'm not going to beat my head against the wall. I'm just going to run with this guy. And so I became Jim Stafford's road manager for 5 years, from the time I was 25 until I was 30. So when you saw me there at the Ice House, I already had 5 years' experience watching someone else deliver my jokes and songs.
Wow, that is astonishing. Now, you said you got a manager out of the Yellow Pages. So this is just a question about the business of show business. Woody Allen, to me, would not have become the filmmaker that he has become, some great and some dreadful, if it had not been for Jack Rollins. I do not think that David Letterman or Dick Cabot would have gotten the talking gigs that they got had it not been for Jack Rollins and Charles Jaffe shaping their careers. And of course, you know that Colonel Parker was almost as famous as Elvis. It strikes me, because of your mind and your energy, that you almost did not need a manager or an agent, but...
That's what I learned, because I was doing the talk shows one day when Ken Cragen, Kenny Rogers' manager, was there because he had the singing duo of the Righteous Brothers on the show. And Ken said to me, I'm starting a new agency and we don't have a comedian. Would you like to be in my agency? And I said, no, I'm doing just fine on my own. Look, I'm on a talk show. And he said, but I can let you open for Kenny Rogers, and he does 100 shows a year. So if we get you $5,000 a night, it'll be $500,000 deal. And I said, okay,
goodness.
I'll sign for 1 year.
Oh, my
And that's
goodness.
What I did. And so I went from the Ice House to 100 of the largest halls in America, opening for Kenny Rogers with Dottie West. And I never worked in the little clubs.
Oh, that
I
is
went
astonishing.
Straight to the 10 and 20,000 seaters.
Did you do the language routine, or did you start working with props then?
Well, I couldn't, because you can't do that in the round in a big auditorium. And so I had to work fast. And so you can't do anything long and theatrical and subtle. And so I didn't do any of that kind of material that was thoughty. Instead, it has to be short. A large crowd is like a child. It doesn't have much of a retention. You have to just do quick, short jokes.
Oh, You did it for a year. Why did you just do it for a year? Because I'm sure that Kenny probably wanted to take you every place. You must have been as much of a hit as he was.
Because there were four buses that went between the shows. There was Dottie's band, and they were doing a hard drug. And then there was Kenny's band, and they were just smoking marijuana. And then there was a bus for the promoter, C.K. Spurlock. And as C.K. was on the phone, I realized that he was really the one running that business because he was choosing the ticket price. And I decided to just follow in his example. And so I promoted my own shows, my whole career, by renting the halls and buying the advertising and running my life myself.
Oh, my goodness. That is such a fabulous, fabulous story. Okay, now let's jump.
If you already draw, you don't need these other people in an office. And I could keep my ticket price low because it's all about the ticket price. And
but
so I always had a $20 ticket.
You weren't getting on. I remember Carson seemed to avoid booking you. And yet he booked Steve Martin, whose material wasn't even as near the comedic value and the inventiveness of your stuff.
But I got through to him by going after his ego. I made up a routine about The Tonight Show called The Tonight Show Home Game, and I had a little Johnny Carson that popped out of a suitcase. And so when I showed that to the crew, then they told Johnny about it, and they had to have me on with Johnny there because I had little dolls inside the suitcase that represented my guests, and I had cut the back end off of a toy horse, and that was Don Rickles. And so and Don Rickles, they died. I think they put me on just because of that one joke.
Oh, my God. Mr. G, that is so...
You can see that on YouTube. The wonderful thing about the internet is it's all there.
Oh, my God, is that wonderful. Now, you mentioned you wanted to get on TV so that your father was talking to you. That I think there's probably more truth than comedy in that. Did you and your father not have a good relationship?
I don't know. It was just a deep relationship. Whether it's good or not, I don't know. But I had he was part of my life, most of my life. We didn't argue or separate.
When you ended up on Showtime, was he delighted with what you were doing?
Well, my father was the kind of a guy that was never impressed with anything. You know, he'd act like, well, I could have done that, you know. And so acted that way. But that was okay. I knew who he was.
Well, obviously, you love to write because that stuff just churns around in your heads. And it's like you're the Tesla of comedy, for crying out loud. How did you end up on Showtime? Did they come to you, or did you go to them?
I think Cragen got me over there. I like when new things start because they're not as fussy as the networks, and they didn't care what you said. Even though I'm not really a dirty comic, they left me alone and just let me create my routines and just videotaped me.
And
I did a new show every 6 months for years.
I know you. Listen, I must tell you, I never, ever missed them. And I used to marvel because I would tell my wife, you should see the stuff that this guy writes that's so intelligent. And now he's transferred it to these props. And ordinarily, that's not the kind of, you know, I was a huge fan of Charles Chaplin, which was very, very visual. Buster Keaton was visual. And, of course, Johnny Winters doing some of his ad-lib routines with Jack Parr was extremely visual. But that's not my kind of comedy, except there was a kind of intelligence in that stuff that you did. And it was hard not... The truth is, it was hard not to love what you were doing. You used to put these umbrellas or these plastic sheets over the front rows and get ready to do your sledge-o-matic. And I couldn't take my eyes off you. And truthfully, I didn't think that was me watching, but I loved it.
Well, obviously America loved it because every amusement park has some kind of a splash ride now, not to mention the rock bands like Quar and Insane Clown Posse and even Blue Man Group. Well, you know, Shamu didn't splash anybody before me, so they must have told Shamu about me.
Why did you stop doing the Showtime specials?
I didn't stop. They stopped asking for one. And I had $100,000 worth of props ready for a new show, and they never wanted it. And part of that show was a foam rubber steamroller. My idea was, after smashing, squashing watermelons, I would squash people. And so I was ready to run over people, and I had the steamroller made in Detroit by automotive people there. It was a wonderful steamroller. And it looked just like a steamroller, except you could squash people because it was all foam rubber for the roller. And I kept that thing in storage for years before I finally got rid of it because they never wanted another show.
Oh, you know what that is? That is right out of Roadrunner cartoons. I mean, it is so endearing. You mean you never got to use it in a stadium? Or can you imagine the crowds that would have loved that if you were doing that at a stadium where they had all these big trucks?
John, my life has just been a series of disappointments. The world doesn't listen to me, and I'm always ready to tell the world something. And they just buttonhole me, pigeonhole me into the guy that smashes watermelons and won't listen to anything else.
Well, I'm telling you, as I looked at your bucket list, and, you know, maybe we could get to a little of that, but before we get to some of that, because, again, it is phenomenal. Like I said, you are the Tesla of comedy, but some of these things are more than comedy. There was very famous incident in your life when your brother asked for permission to do your act, and you granted him.
Well, it really didn't go that way. My brother would ask for money, and I said to him, why don't you just go do my older jokes? Because I had maybe 6 or 7 shows at that time, hours of material. I told him, do the jokes from the first 3 hours, and smash a watermelon at the end, and work in small clubs and ballrooms of hotels, because I was working big 2,000-seaters on my own, and that's what I told him. And so I got a club owner, Tom Sobel, who owned the club in Chattanooga, I think, and no, it was another town, can't remember quite yet, and he properly advertised for 5 years that it was not me, it was my brother. But then my brother left Tom and got involved with a bunch of promoters who said to him, why don't you charge $25 and they won't know it's not Gallagher? When you charge $12, it gives it away. And so my brother started doing that, and I couldn't stop him, and I had to sue him. And my father took his side against me.
Why would your father do that?
Well, I guess he was jealous. So much of my life is about jealousy. I think people that are close to you are jealous of what you're doing and what you've accomplished.
That's true. You know why? Because you are following your joy. You're following your bliss, as Joseph Campbell said, and you were succeeding at it. And you're one in a million who can do that and succeed at it. Right now.
I did notice that I had a talent for it, and so I decided to go with my talent, even though I wanted to be a scientist. I don't know, maybe I believe in reincarnation, and I was a comedian in some other life, but it just comes natural to me. And like when I see another comic, I write jokes for them, and when I come up after the show, I just give them the jokes, because they're not for me. They're just ideas that pop in my head for them. I have jokes in so many people's careers and in their shows. I enjoy doing that, and I'm not doing it for money. I just want to, my ideas, their best thing.
You know what's astonishing, Mr. G? Nikola Tesla, who is probably one of the great geniuses, may have topped even Einstein for crying out loud. He said he never sat down to think of anything and plan how, if he was going to conduct an experiment for a new kind of motor or alternating current, he said he would just relax and it would appear in his head. And he felt he was just serving as a stenographer, writing down what popped into his head. It's though it came from someplace else. Well, you are that kind of comedian. And
yes, I never took much credit for my ideas because they don't seem to be engineered. I don't do anything to make them appear. They just pop in your head and you have the idea. It doesn't take any time at all. I just used to carry a piece of paper with me all the time and jot them down, and I stayed very organized. And now I just have an iPad, and I write everything down, and it amounts to a whole lot.
What kind of relationship? I know the lawsuit was resolved in your favor. What kind of relationship, if any, do you have with your brother now?
I don't have any relationship. Once you become a famous person and you have millions of people who love you, your family doesn't seem that important because, like I said, they seem jealous. And everywhere else I go, people love me. So why would I go to a place where I wasn't appreciated? And so I enjoy, like when I had a heart attack and the bank took my houses, I didn't care. I just wandered around the town I was in until some of my fans found me and they took me to their house.
Hold it just a second. You had a heart attack. Tell me about the heart attack.
I've had four, John. I've died four times. How many times have you died?
on stage or off? Truth is, I only died
two times on stage. You can go on YouTube and see two of my heart attacks.
Oh, my goodness gracious. And then you said your houses were taken away. Was that after 2008?
Yes. Uh-huh. When Obama said, I guess you just can't go to Las Vegas on vacation, my ticket sales dropped off immediately that day. And I struggled for several years after that, just trading dollars, making payments on $3 million houses that I had. And finally, when I had a heart attack, I couldn't go and work. And so but I never cared for those houses. Anyway, I never wore jewelry or bought Ferraris. I don't care about money that much. And so I just, my riches are my fans.
Well, you're right. You know what? Money is a byproduct of the love that you have for doing comedy and making people happy. Are you married? Have you been married? Do you have children?
Oh, yeah. I've been married four times, but I only married two of them. I was smart enough not to marry
four times and died four times, I see.
Well, I had two long relationships with women in which I did not marry. But there's been four women. But nothing now because I can't really bring anything to a relationship. I can't say to a woman, you ought to bet on me. I mean, I could die during this interview. The way it works is you just end up collapsing.
Yes, but do you realize, I bet there are dozens of women listening of all ages who would just love to hug you and take care of you. I mean, maybe
well, we do that in the lobby, John. I go out in the lobby and then they squeeze my butt when we're posing for a picture. They reach around behind and squeeze my butt.
Did you tell them it's the wrong side?
No, I know what they're up to.
Well, that is just fabulous. Do you have children?
Yes, I've got a daughter, 32, and she has two grandchildren of mine, in Phoenix, Arizona, and then I have a son, 27, and I'm helping him to have a career in show business. He plays the sitar and is an accomplished sitarist.
My gosh, the only sitar player I ever heard of, wasn't that Indian in the 60s who played the sitar?
Oh, I'm very familiar with him because my son plays his videos on his computer all the time and then plays it for me on his sitar.
Ravi Shankar.
That's right. But Ravi's not as good as his daughter. And
you're
so
kidding.
We watch videos of his daughter playing.
Oh, because I met Ravi. World Pacific Jazz was the label which put out my comedy album, It's Tough to Be White. And then about 10 years later, when I was a critic, then I became really good friends of Neil Simons, who was just a sweet, sweet soul. And he asked if he could do the liner notes on my second album, which was called I Met a Man I Didn't Like, which is based on a lot of the reviews that I did. And about 5 months later, he called me and he said, you know what, John, the liner notes on your album, that's the only unsuccessful writing I've ever done. Anyway.
Well, I really wanted to be a songwriter. I don't, you know, comedy is so easy, and writing jokes for drunks at night is pretty easy to do, but songs are hard. And that's what I really want to do, and I'm having a real hard time finding the musical other half of me.
Well, maybe it's your son who can help you do that.
No, he's only interested in Indian music.
Then write a song related to Indians. I'm trying to think of the, oh, God, you would know him in an instant. He's sort of country western, and he writes a lot of funny songs. Gosh, I can't remember his name. But
well, it doesn't matter. Once again, you know, your family's not the place to go. My son doesn't want to work with me. He wants his own life separate.
Okay. Your bucket list. You said a lot of people don't want to hear what you have to say. Well,
I had a meeting with Donald Trump 3-4 years ago, and I was going to give him some of my ideas that he should have taken. They'd help him now, but he canceled the meeting. This is what happens to me all the time. They just think that I'm just a guy that smashes watermelons, and they won't listen to any other ideas.
What were a couple of the ideas that you would give Trump that would help?
Well,
I have
a patent on new software for slot machines, so you can play them on mobile devices like iPads and phones. And at that time, he had casinos. And I knew that if Amazon ruined the bookstore business, that online gaming would ruin casinos. And I wanted to show him how he could continue to have income from gaming after it goes online. And then I also have an idea for family reunion facilities, because hotels are not a good place for kids to run around loose. And those two big ideas I wanted him to listen to, and never got there.
They're brilliant, and they're on your bucket list, and your bucket list has 24 or 25 items. A number of them caught my eye because they're just, I mean, they're so imaginative, and they're so good. This duck poem, which is number 9. Tell me about duck poem.
Well, I'm concerned that 1 out of 3 kids is overweight, and they don't want to eat anything that doesn't gratify them immediately, like sugar and grease in their mouth. And how do we get kids to want to eat vegetables and fruits, living things? And I got the idea of a duck, because they eat on the bottom of the lake different colored plants. And if a duck had a porthole, because a duck is really a boat, we
right.
could see inside. And so when the kids eat colored food, they get a sticker to put on their belly that is a porthole and shows that they've eaten a rainbow of food. Because
oh,
I understand
how
adorable. Kids, and you got to have a game. And so I want to get that to Michelle Obama. I put it right there on my website. If somebody would tell her about it, I think it would help her in her efforts to get the kids to eat a balanced
Mr.
lunch.
Mr. G, I have a better idea, a much better idea, and you can do it tonight, or you could do it tomorrow, or one of your representatives could do it. Sesame Street is moving to HBO. You could do this wonderful stuff on HBO on the new Sesame Street. You would be an absolute smash. The kids would love you. The adults would love you. And also, you could do, you have number 11, King Arthritis and the Knights of the Vegetable. That is just wonderful stuff.
That's another poem idea that I had to also help kids to want to eat different foods. And King Arthritis, because you know when you don't eat properly, you get gout. And that is called the King's disease, and it starts in the big toe. And so when you only eat pheasant and sweet meats like the king always did, he got gout. And so I said he should send his knights of the vegetable to the far corners of the earth to come back with different vegetables, because if you don't eat meat, it seems boring. I thought to myself, I wonder what's on the table in King Arthur's court. And of course, they couldn't have potatoes or tomatoes because they came from the New World. Imagine eating without red sauce on your spaghetti in Italy until Columbus came back with a tomato. So I thought, well, Merlin will make these vegetables appear, and then they'll cook them. And so that was another idea to help people to teach kids to eat more balanced
meals. There are two more thoughts that crop into my head. I mean, you would have been perfect having a 4 or 5 minute segment every week on Jon Stewart on Comedy Central. They have the guy that used to be on Comedy Central that is now going to take over their nighttime show following Letterman on CBS. You could do that. And HBO also has this Englishman. Now, I don't care for him, but he does have some funny writers. My son absolutely loves him. You should be doing a segment on his show. You have so much to offer that is so enjoyable, where we laugh and learn. Now you have also, I'm thinking about, are there a couple of investment shows that I accidentally watch sometimes on CNN? You're number 16, the Democratic Investment Club. What a fabulous idea.
Well, I've lost a lot of money in the market listening to Jim Cramer. And I thought, you know, once you invest, you want to talk about it. And so
yes,
the internet is about talking. So I thought, what a great idea to let people vote on what stocks their club should own. And they would also learn about the legislative process. They would present the stock as a bill. It would go to the floor and be discussed. And then they'd vote on it. And then they would buy it. And in that way, you could join a club that was doing good and not vote and let them big deals make you some money. I thought it would be a lot of fun. And I tried to get to Jim Cramer, and Cramer won't listen to me either. He thinks I'm a nut, and he won't take a meeting with me.
Well, you shouldn't be talking to Cramer, because he's not smart enough, and he doesn't have the wit to understand what it is you're doing. You should be on the kind of show that I'm talking about. Also,
but he copied me. He's doing one day on his show, he says, I'm the Gallagher of finance, but he wouldn't have a meeting with me. You know, I almost am tired of Earth, and I'm going to go to another planet, because these people are not listening.
Okay, then. I hope you're healthy enough to do this. There are a number of people, and some of them are 16-year-old kids, putting out funny videos and weird videos out of California and all around the world, who are making quite a bit of money putting up these videos. These things that you're talking about in the bucket list all would be phenomenal. They would be absolutely show-stopping viral videos that you could produce. Look at this one, number 17, Damn the Bay of California. I mean, that is so relevant today. Expand on that.
Well, I was looking at a map, and I realized that we were wasting all the water that comes down the Colorado when we need all the fresh water that is produced, especially in this time of a drought. We ought to dam about halfway down. There's some islands, so I know it must be shallow there, and put a dam right there and save all the Colorado River water that's rich in fertilizer that's washed off of the farmers' land. That way the Mexicans wouldn't have to come up to the United States to grow the avocados and the other things that we want, and we wouldn't have the pressure on our school system and our hospitals, and the drug lords could do this and straighten up and get legal and quit doing drugs. They already know how to grow things.
Another one I absolutely loved. It is something that Donald Trump certainly wouldn't endorse. If you heard about it, he wouldn't want to meet with you. But that's the women-only enterprise zone. And I must tell you, there probably isn't a female on the planet who wouldn't want to join that group.
Well, I feel so bad for the women in the Middle East who can't have a life. They are kept from getting an education and having a career. And I just felt like if they had a place they could walk to, if they could get away from the oppressive family situation that they're in and find people to support them. And so I thought, why can't there be a place where men are not allowed and the women can? It's just like these shelters. Except they would help them to have a career also.
Well, I think that...
I think
that,
Oprah should do this in the Middle East.
Well...
But I can't get to Oprah either.
Well, I don't know where Oprah's gone, because I remember... I always thought that Oprah was a very, very good interviewer. She was very comfortable.
She's going to have a talk show again, but why don't you send her my bucket list? People believe in something if they hear it from somebody else.
Well, listen, I'm going to send your bucket list to a lot of people, and I'm going to also send it to my son. My son is now, he was recently the co-executive producer and one of the writers on CSI Las Vegas, which this year was canceled. Then he was hired immediately to write on Criminal Minds with Gary Sinise, and I will send it to him because he has a wonderful agent and manager who could get this into the right kinds of hands. I must say, I am no longer a fan of Oprah Winfrey's. I think that Oprah was one of the two few talk show hosts in America who could have stopped the fake war in Iraq. She had a couple of military guys on after George Bush said that, you know, you're either with us or against us, and we're going to get them dead or alive, and all that fake nonsense. And she had a couple of CIA people and a couple of brass from the Pentagon on, and a woman who was young, 32 or 33, stood up in the audience when it was question time and asked about the proof about weapons of mass destruction weren't there. Why isn't somebody else on this panel? And Oprah told her to sit down. And I turned her off and never turned her on again. And to me, one of the great, great artists in America in the last 100 years has been the black artist who first sang Old Man River in the original, his name escapes me, and I'm sorry, but you know who I'm talking about. He was a political
activist. No, I'm as old as you. I've had 4 heart attacks. My hard drive is corrupted. I can't think of any word that begins with a capital letter, whether it's
a city or a person's name. Paul Robeson. Paul Robeson is the greatest black artist ever in the history of America. He was destroyed by the FBI, and as it was, the FBI had lost a lawsuit to the Coretta King family because they took the FBI and the federal government to court, holding them civilly responsible for the murder of her husband, and they won the case. And you never hear about the settlement that the government and the FBI had to make. Well, they did worse to Paul Robeson, that great, brilliant artist. You would think that Spike Lee or Oprah Winfrey or Washington or any of Morgan Freeman, the best actor in America today, would do a documentary or a film about Paul Robeson, and they avoid it. They avoid anything that's of meaning except what you have done with this bucket list. You make us smile and think and accept at the very, very same time. And one of the things that I love, which is especially great for men and women, husband and wife relationships, is number 24, and 24 happens to be my birthday. It's the wishing eggs. Tell me about the wishing eggs.
My idea there is that when you talk face-to-face, people bring up other things, and it starts an argument. So the wishing egg is put on the bureau in the bedroom, and when she wants you to do something, she writes it on a piece of paper, puts it in the egg, and then you're smart enough to go and look in the egg and see what she wants you to do without having to have a big argument about it. And so I wrote a little poem that explains it. Yeah, I think Ellen would like that. I should be on Ellen sometime.
You're absolutely... Do you have a little bit of that poem handy?
No, I'm standing on the street outside my son's apartment because he's playing the sitar inside, and you don't want to hear it for this whole interview.
Wait a minute.
Can you
You've been doing this whole interview outside in the street in Phoenix where it's over 100 even at night?
No, I'm in Los Angeles in the street, but could you post my bucket list somewhere?
You're absolutely, you're kidding. I will put it up there absolutely immediately. I'll go over it and make sure that it's all spelled right.
The poem is on the bucket list, isn't it?
I beg your pardon?
The poem is, for the egg, the wishing egg, is on the bucket list, so they can read the poem.
That's right, it is. Okay, now, you are obviously performing, and obviously you're going to do a show in Los Angeles. Why have you not had another special on something like Comedy Central or even HBO or even back at Showtime with Gallagher?
They don't want me. They know where I am. You got my phone number. You called. All of them could call. They don't want me. I'm going to be in Atlanta, Orlando, Nashville, Pensacola, Birmingham, Bethesda, Wilkes-Barre. I'm going to be out on the coast, Lawrence, Oregon. I'm going to be in San Antonio, Texas. It's all on my website. I'm working with two other comedians. I've invented a whole new way of performing where three comics are on stage the whole time, and you don't just do it like a tag team where one does their act and then the next one does their. Me and Artie Fletcher and Bob Nelson are performing as the new Marx Brothers on stage the whole time.
Oh, how wonderful. Okay, your website. How do people get a hold of your website? And
you just search Gallagher, and my website is at the top of the search results. But if you have to know, you just put Gallagher Smash. But all you really need to do is search Gallagher, and my website comes up, and it's very simple. And you can see my duck poem, my penguin poem, and a song called Rock Solid. And if any musical people want to put put music to it, that'd be wonderful. But I've got at least 50 songs. I'm just looking for my other musical half.
Well, I must tell you, Mr. G, I just admire you and respect you and enjoy you so much. And I'm so glad that you survived those heart attacks, those four heart attacks, and those four wives. And I just can't thank you enough for coming on this hour. When it's over, I will post your bucket list, and I'll send it off to folks that I think should have it, even though they don't listen to me a whole lot anymore either. But it would be my pleasure and honor to be able to do that. And once again, thank you. Thank you so much. And if at any time you want somebody to pay attention to you, you call me and you can do another hour. Because you notice, I didn't take one single break because I didn't want to waste a second of your time or the audience's time in hearing you.
But all the things we talked about are important and can make the world a better place. And that's what we need to do before we die, is make the world a better place. And even though I made them laugh, I have other ideas, and I want to share them with everyone.
Well, there's no question that you can do that, and very few people know that Hedy Lamarr was a genius who invented mechanical stuff that's still used to this day, and her estate still has the copyright on. So there's much more to a Gallagher than a joke. There's a heart, and there's a soul, and there's a brain that is still working. Please, Mike.
That's right.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being here, and I am looking forward to doing this again before your next heart attack or your next wife.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Be careful on the street. Get in the house.
I'm going there now.
Okay. Thank you, everyone.
Bye-bye.
So much. I had a wonderful, wonderful evening, and I hope you did too. And I'll talk to you again next Monday. Good night.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 sunny. I love you.